So before we begin again, did you have a question left over, please? I wouldn't say they're necessarily mostly impulsive or unconscious. I think, that is entirely related to the level of mindfulness that is present. I mean, obviously, much of our actions and our speech and indeed our thinking, is habitual. So in this level, on that level, it's certainly what we would call unconscious intention. But it's also, I think, quite clear in the practice that habit and mindfulness do not actually coexist. That's pretty crucial to be aware of, that habit and mindfulness, try to habitually and mindfully tie your shoes in the same moment. Simply it doesn't work. Mindfulness always, if it's there as a conscious intention, always trumps habit, we might say. Okay? Then there is the remembering to be mindful, which is an intentional gesture of the mind. It initially requires effort, but as I say, or as I suggested earlier, the rewards, actually, of mindfulness are actually so profound in terms of aliveness, sense of connectedness, sense of embodiment, sense of knowing, sense of remembering, that what initially requires a good deal of effort becomes much less effortless, much more effortless. Because, it's almost as if someone suggested to you, what would you like for lunch, a bucket of nails or a nice meal? Most of us would go for the good meal and not the bucket of nails. So that it increasingly becomes naturalized, that the mind inclines towards conscious intention because it is a happier, a more ethical, a more alive place to live. Because those many thousands of moments of unconsciousness you speak of, they're often, not in the realm of kind of major decisive acts. They're in the realm of the many domains of many moments of habit that can simply govern our day, that, we're kind of prone to think they don't really matter. But of course they do. Yes, please.
So, mindfulness will not show you the exit door.
Mindfulness will?
It will not show the exit door.
Oh, it will.
If I am lost, is it intention intention I had before that will help me get out of the hole that I fell into again?
Our capacity to remember, our capacity to return to a more awake and conscious way of being, I think, becomes increasingly accessible to us. It's very hard to turn off awareness completely once it begins to turn on, as much as we would sometimes like to be able to throw that switch. It becomes increasingly difficult to do that. And so the periods of time of being completely lost do get much shorter, unless we really strategize around making them longer. the remembering comes back far more easily to us, and sometimes that's an uncomfortable remembering, isn't it? Because it's I think of people on retreat, sometimes kind of, you know, Gaia House is a walkable store, you know, and how many people tell me they set out on that walk, you know, just for the comfort of a chocolate bar or, you know, some moment of just unadulterated forgetfulness, you know, and how disappointed they are that it's so hard to get. Not the chocolate bar, but the moment of unadulterated forgetfulness, you know. It's quite difficult to turn off. So, you know, remember what I said earlier, to what the mind inclines, this it becomes? You know, and increasingly intention is cultivating a certain way of inclining the mind, isn't it? And the mind learns to take that shape much more easily, you know, to rest in that much more easily. It's an interesting point, I think, in practice where it starts to take more effort to be forgetful. It's a good sign. It's a very good sign. Because it used to take no effort at all, you know, and then it takes some effort to be completely forgetful. And it's the way in which, you know, mindfulness is a sort of way of being present, a way of remembering to be present, increasingly becomes, I think, more naturalized as a shape, an inclination of the mind. I wanted to withdraw my comment that it takes, or modify my comment that it takes very little effort to seek forgetfulness, as I just went for a quick walk in that break and I happened to stumble across the first legal marijuana store with a long line of people standing outside in the rain. And I thought, that takes some effort. That takes some effort. Maybe it didn't take much effort to get there, to have the intention, you know, or the impulse, but maybe it takes effort to sometimes translate those unconscious impulses into embodied action.
We're going to open an IKEA store right next door.
Double whammy. Okay. It's interesting, this word, intention, and the shape, the way that it is flavored, you know. So intention as a word alone is somewhat ethically quite neutral, I think, because we see that as long as we live, we will act, we will speak, we will think, and yet our acts and our speech and our thoughts are not random in the sense that they do not arise from nowhere. It is the roots of those acts and thoughts and speech that we're really asked to be mindful of. And when we speak about the roots of intention, of course, it's very important to take this out of the context of being right or wrong or good or bad, because we're really speaking about the human condition. And, you know, the Buddha was quite clear in saying that there are three primary roots that are broad spectrum roots, but there's three primary roots that underlie most, I think, if not all, impulsive and reactive behavior, psychologically or in speech or in action. And I think it's good to check this out for yourself. And when the Buddha spoke about the three primary roots, of course, he's speaking about the three roots of greed or craving, of aversion or ill will, and of delusion, or what is often defined as avidya or ignorance. Now, if we actually look in our lives at any moment of suffering, any moment of regret, any moment of shame or conflict or struggle, we would be likely to see the imprint of these three roots. And when we hear the word, you know, greed, it sounds like a very heavy word, it sounds like a very big word, but it's such a big spectrum word, isn't it? We just want things to be different than they are. And we just, you know, it has its own roots, which I'll speak about much later, in the sense of just not being enough, not having enough, not feeling to be enough, yes. And so, you know, the roots of craving and greed arise, and we think about how that funnels through into our thoughts, into our speech, into our actions, into our perceptions. Buddha speaks about the root of ill will, which again, or hatred, sounds like a terribly big word. But ill will can be quite a familiar companion in terms of irritation, shame, judgment, impatience, frustration, comparing. I even think of fantasy as a kind of ill will because it's such an abandonment of what is. And of course, delusion or ignorance is also a very big spectrum word. And, you know, the Buddha speaks about ignorance really as a distortion in seeing, you know, the distortion of seeing the impermanent to be permanent, you know, the distortion of seeing there to be a solid, centralized self where there isn't one. The distortion of seeing the unbeautiful to be beautiful. The distortion of seeing the unsatisfactory to be satisfactory. And that these kind of three roots, you know, they are in a way often quite unconscious domains or latent tendencies that spring into consciousness and into intention through contact. Basically, you know, I mean, there are plenty of moments in our day, you know, where greed is not operating. There are plenty of moments in our day where ill will is not operative. There's plenty of moments in our day which are quite empty of self. We tend not to notice those moments. And we begin to see the way that, you know, these primary imprinting patterns that flow through into intention, you know, kind of spring from latency into activity through contact with the sight, contact with the body sensation, contact with the sound, contact with the thought, that suddenly we find those primary patterns arising. And the thing is, they move from latency into activity very, very quickly, and this is what we call impulse, isn't it? This is what we call reaction, that kind of knee-jerk flinch away from, or that, you know, impulsive movement towards, or just the complete distortion of what we're seeing. Does anybody have any disagreement with that? I'm very happy for disagreement, by the way. I don't really need to be right. Does anybody have any questions about that? Can you find any impulsive action, thought, or speech in your life which lies outside of those three? Yes, Candace? Under the same umbrella? I mean, fantasy, you know, it's a curious mixture, I think, of craving and ill will. You know, and craving and ill will, of course, these are not separate compartmentalized tendencies. They are interfacing with one another all of the time. You know, every moment of craving is generally also a moment of ill will. We don't want what is here and we want what is there. You know, and you think about fantasy in that sense. The present moment is quite unsatisfying. I don't want it. I abandon it, and the mechanism I use to abandon it is to imagine some much better, idealized, lovely moment. And if I'm not finding it in my life, I will find it in my thoughts. You know, so those two are so, you know, the two impulses are so interwoven, and I think it's often quite difficult to find the presence of one without the trigger of the other. I have an impulse to want something, then I want to get rid of something. I want to get rid of something, I have the impulse to want something other. So they're pretty interactive patterns as far as I can see. It is why I find it so difficult myself, you know, this kind of idea of defining ourselves by a type, you know, that I'm a greed type, or I'm an aversion type, or I'm a delusion type, because I think, how can you be just one of those? You know, mostly we're mutts, we're hybrids, you know, we're mongrel types, we're all mixed up together. We might specialize slightly more in one inclination than the other, but we cannot classify that distinctly, I don't feel.
Would you distinguish between the impulse to help or to do something on the spur of the moment that is not greed or ill will?
Well, I think it's very, very clear in our own experience that we all encounter moments of unhesitating compassion, unhesitating movement to reach out to help another. And, you know, those unhesitating moments are very precious, and they are real glimpses, actually, of the quality of responsiveness that is not going through the filters of, you know, how do I benefit, or is this a good thing to do? And I don't feel that that falls within the realm of impulse. Yeah. Personally, I wouldn't feel that falls within the, you know, because when I'm speaking about the word impulse, I'm speaking about a very, very specific way of being a reactive mechanism that is really rooted in those three roots, whereas action and speech and thought that is rooted in compassion and care is in a different domain. Yeah.
About delusion.
Well, I think they can only happen because of delusion. You know, I think greed and hatred can only happen because of delusion. Because, you know, if you go back to those kind of four distortions I was talking about, you know, seeing the impermanent to be permanent. That's the root of a lot of aversion, isn't it? You know, seeing the unsatisfactory to be satisfactory. I mean, that's the root of a lot of craving. You know, seeing there to be a reified self where there may be no centralized self. I mean, that is the root of a great deal of, you know, both aversion and craving, because we're employing the mechanisms to keep that going, you know, seeing the unbeautiful to be beautiful, you know, such as, the classic, you know, the most extreme example would be something like anorexia, you know, seeing the unbeautiful to be beautiful, seeing addiction to be beautiful, you know, seeing even fantasy to be beautiful. It is a mechanism, isn't it, that sets a lot in motion in terms of pursuit. You know, so I'm quite sure that ill will and craving cannot happen without that foundation of delusion or avidya. You know, because that's talking about not seeing things clearly, not seeing things how they actually are. You know, and it seems to me that ill will and craving rely upon not seeing things as they actually are, in terms of being transient, in terms of being unstable, in terms of being unable to provide lasting happiness or freedom. So in a way, craving and ill will can't really operate without those distortions being in place. It's a triad. It's almost, I think of craving and or greed and ill will as being the active mechanisms of delusion. You know, because a lot of times delusion, we can't really spot it, can we? We can't sort of look inwardly and at this moment say, you know, where is the delusion? Whereas craving and ill will and clearly craving are very energetic senses. I mean, they are very felt experiences. But I think of them as being, you know, it's almost like a volcanic process, you know, that you've got the sort of latent, dormant volcano, and then you get a trigger, and the volcano moves into a much more active phase in ill will or in craving. And that's the way that delusion is moving from latency into activity. You know, so I think it's but of course then craving and ill will feed back, don't they, to reinforce those delusions. You know, because they don't have clear answers. You know, craving doesn't actually serve its purpose, does it? It's quite, what do you call it? There's a phrase for that. It's operatively ineffective. It's operatively ineffective. It doesn't serve its purpose. I mean, craving and getting what I want is supposed to make me happy. And so it's operatively ineffective, you know, because it keeps not delivering. And so that feeds back to the delusion that says, well, I just haven't either figured out the right thing to crave or haven't done it in the right way yet.
Yeah.
You know, so I need to be more successful in this. So it's feeding back into that. I mean, ill will is operatively ineffective. You know, aversion does not make something go away. In fact, it will almost guarantee that it stays. So it's pretty much operatively ineffective. But that will feed back into the delusion that says, well, again, you know, I just haven't been strategic enough, you know, in getting rid of things, you know. So it's a curious phenomenon that these patterns, these impulses that can consume so much energy and so much time keep not delivering. I mean, if you went to a store and bought something that didn't deliver, you know, your coffee maker didn't work, you would not go by and buy 100 more of the same model. You know, we would learn. We would say, this is not actually a good choice. But psychologically and emotionally, we don't seem to be able to learn the same lessons about operational ineffectiveness. Which is kind of curious, isn't it? Operational ineffectiveness. I mean, it's not even that it's bad or it's wrong, it just doesn't deliver. You know, it doesn't work. Yeah, and delusion is more, you know, craving and ill will are more the active visible faces of delusion, but delusion gets reinforced through their operative ineffectiveness. I like that. Anything else? Yes, please. For the Jews.
There's something else entirely going on there.
I mean, this is more, I mean, if we were to name that, it's more catastrophe fantasy, isn't it? Which is, you know, all the things that could go wrong. You know, fantasy can have its roots in the craving mechanism of imagining the delights, and it can have its roots in the aversion mechanism, which is imagining the disasters. And it's almost, sometimes that kind of fantasy is almost, I think, a kind of conviction that if I think this, it's already happened, so it's not really going to happen. But it is in the aversion family. Okay, well, I think it's too late in the day for me to start on a whole another piece, but tomorrow I think we're slightly moving into the good news piece. No, there's a little bit more bad. I'm sorry about that. But it's tempered, shall we say. It's tempered.